There we are. Good afternoon. It is 12:02. Eric Scott here on WASR, and today we have a little bit different different guest. Usually, Dean Rondeau, Wolfboro Police Chief, is with us, but today we have a little bit more timely guest, and his name is Dr. Michael Matos. He works for Huggins Hospital. He's also the school doctor for Brewster Academy. Doctor, thank you for waiting. I do appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having me on today. Appreciate it.
I appreciate that. What brought you into pediatrics?
In pediatrics, children are often hit by something kind of out of the blue. It's nothing that's been going on in their lives for a long time that sort of led to their problems. They're either born with something or they get hit with some infection or something. And so they get sick pretty quickly, and then most of the time they get better quickly. And I really enjoyed that part of medicine.
That makes sense. How long have you been with Huggins Hospital?
I've been here since I finished my training, which was 2003. So I've been here for a while.
Yeah, has been. What do you think of it here?
Oh, I love the area. As soon as I heard there was an opening way back in 2002, I jumped at it because I knew this place. It was where I wanted to be.
Well, you've got a very nice resume, including Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and residency in Boston. It's impressive. Now, as a pediatrician, you must get a lot of questions about COVID.
All the time. Yep.
Yeah, I figured. And I got to admit, as someone who is just, you know, based on what I see in the news or read in the newspapers, the messaging seems to be inconsistent.
That's probably true.
You know,
yeah. And I think what's throwing people as far as messages is we're watching science in real time. So most of the time when we are studying in high school and grade school, we're looking at things that have been tested over and over and over and have been followed for 20 or 30 years, and we're looking at all that data together. With COVID, what I think people are seeing for the first time is the scientists, particularly at the CDC, and they're doing this in New Hampshire as well, at the Health and Human Services, they get the data, they see what happens and what seems to be most effective. Like they said, wear masks because they will prevent you from getting other people sick. And then as they got more data, they realized, well, you should wear masks because it prevents you from getting sick. And so you'll hear the recommendations change because of what they're seeing with the data. And that's been confusing for people, I think, but that's how science really works. Scientists don't just look at something once and decide, yep, that's the answer and we're done. As they get more data, they have to say, well, now things are changing, or what we thought before wasn't quite right, and now we have a better idea of what's going on.
Right. Well, let's start at the beginning. Yeah. The idea of a coronavirus is not new.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong here. You're the one with the letters after his name. A coronavirus is like the common cold.
Most of them are, exactly.
Okay. Now, which I've always wanted to ask, I guess since I've got you on, is it true that you never get that version of a cold again? You're immune to that particular virus mutation?
Well, I wouldn't say you never get it again, but if you do get it again, your body's already primed to fight it off. And that's the whole reason that we do vaccinations, is you teach the body this is what the germ looks like, and then if you run into the germ, you may get sick, but your body's able to clear it very quickly because it's already sort of, you know, ready to go.
Oh, okay. How does the common cold mutate that much?
So, to give us what we have now?
Yeah, I mean, because face it, a lot of us get colds at least once a year.
Yep. Nobody's really sure how it came about to make such a big difference, but generally what happens with viruses that's different from us is when our cells make copies of ourselves, there's sort of a proofreading process that goes on. So as our DNA is being copied, it's copied exactly. And if there's a mistake, those processes in the cells that make those copies back up, correct the mistake, and keep going. And viruses don't have that proofreading property. So when they make copies of themselves, and when they infect a cell, they're making hundreds of thousands of copies they don't have that proofreading effect. So some of those are going to be very different from the one that was originally infecting the cell. They sort of make mistakes, and when they make mistakes, they don't correct them. Some of those viruses that are made that are the mistakes or the mutations, those are going to not even work. And other ones, unfortunately, like COVID-19, that virus sticks very well to certain receptors in our bodies.
And is that what is meant by this new Delta strain, that somehow it's stickier?
It's got several properties that unfortunately make it more effective as a virus. I saw three or four different specific mutations that made it the new Delta virus. And the most important one is it's almost twice as infective as the original virus. So with the original virus, they generally, when they did the population surveillance, they saw that if one person had it and was exposed to other people, generally two people might get the virus from that one person. But with Delta, it's more like somewhere around four or five people will get infected. And that's one of the scary things, is it has the potential, and we've seen this in other parts of the world, to increase very quickly.
Now, I know it's anecdotal evidence, but a lot of people have moved up here, especially from New York, during the pandemic, to kind of ride this out here. Are we doing that much better than other places?
Actually, I would say we're doing very well in Wolfboro specifically. Let's see, I can tell you, New Hampshire in general has a high vaccination rate. But even within New Hampshire, it varies a lot. So in Wolfboro, our population is very well vaccinated, about 76% of the population. And you may remember from the news that they were talking about maybe 75 to 80% is what we're hoping for, at least with the original strain. With Delta, maybe even need more of the population in order for it to be fully effective. But that's in Wolfboro. And then when you look at the surrounding towns, and I should mention that New Hampshire has the Department of Health and Human Services has a really great interactive map. You can pull it up. You can look at most of the data is countywide, but some of it is town-specific, and the vaccinations are town-specific. So Wolfboro is about 76% vaccinated, but the surrounding towns, it's only about 45 to 55%. And so you can see that even though we're all very well vaccinated in Wolfboro, people going in and out of town, it really leaves us kind of still susceptible as a larger population to having more spread.
Now, from the beginning, this has been a disease that seems to target the elderly and other people with risk. Is that a principle of the virus, or is it because the elderly are just more sensitive to things like that in general?
It's specific to the virus because there are some viruses that mostly children get, but in general, when elderly people get cold viruses, they do get sicker. And with COVID, that's definitely been the case. With Delta, what we've seen, though, is, and again, you just actually had this on your little news break there. With Delta, we are seeing a lot more children becoming ill compared to the original strain.
And does the Delta strain make people sicker, or is it just more contagious?
It seems like it's a little bit of both. So as I said, we're definitely seeing more children who have to be hospitalized, and that wasn't so much the case with the original virus. And as I did say earlier, that it is definitely more infective, about twice as much than the original strain.
You've worked, you are the medical director for the Camp Carefree in New Durham.
Yes.
And how did that go as far as COVID infections? Was everybody able to stay safe and be campers?
No. So unlike a lot of camps around, so when we look at children, the risk factors for having severe disease are a little bit different from adults. As you said, folks who are older, they're at higher risk for having to be in the hospital, and if they are in the hospital, they're at higher risk for being put in the intensive care unit. And it's also true for people who have cancers, kidney disease, lung disease, heart disease, and things like Down syndrome, diabetes. So that's in the adult population. Within the pediatric population, type 1 diabetes, which is most of the campers that you're talking about, is the highest risk for somebody having to be in the hospital, and it's also the highest risk for children to develop severe disease and need to be in an intensive care unit. So the American Diabetes Association decided for 2020, and again for this year, that there was going to be no diabetes camp, unfortunately.
It's unfortunate.
And that's true throughout, and that's true throughout the whole nation.
Okay, so it's not a New Hampshire decision.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure it was based on what's best for the kids, but...
We knew that the children of the camping age, because they go from about age 8 through 15, a lot of those campers weren't able to be vaccinated yet, and just wasn't going to be a safe situation.
Let's talk about vaccines for a minute, Doctor.
Yeah.
By the way, my guest, Michael Maddox, Dr. Michael Maddox, I should say, who's a PCP at Huggins Hospital. He's a pediatrician, and we're talking about COVID-19 and children today. If you have a question, 569-5253, and we'll be happy to have you join the discussion. So when you see children, as far as, with their parents and you talk about the vaccines and such, is there the same resistance from a certain number of people that adults have, or are our parents more willing to accept the vaccine?
That varies a lot.
Okay.
So, again, in Wolfboro, just specifically looking at the pediatric population, about 83% of the kids are vaccinated.
Oh, okay.
But I looked at the surrounding towns, and that's more like 25 to 30%.
I wonder why that is.
I'm not sure exactly. I think, they've seen throughout the United States, this seems to be almost that politicized dichotomy where people who voted one way get vaccinated, people who voted the other way don't. But we're a lot more similar, Wolfboro versus the surrounding towns, so I couldn't really say that applied. So I'm not sure what the big difference is, why, these families come to us from all the surrounding towns, and why those in Wolfboro really chose much more than others, I'm not sure.
Okay. If, let's try that again. Okay. My guest is Dr. Michael Maddox from Wolfboro Pediatrics, part of Huggins Hospital, and our number 569-5253. So we're talking about vaccines, and is there a point to vaccinating younger kids than 12 at this point, which is where the emergency authorization cuts off? In your opinion, as a doctor, do you think it's a good idea to vaccinate kids younger than 12?
I do, and the reason is partly because children tend to be the vectors. They tend to be the ones who carry the virus. So even those who aren't terribly ill, I had a family come in just this morning. This girl developed some cold symptoms, and she was only tested because both of the parents had just been diagnosed with COVID. And the mother told me that she had gotten, the way she described it, she said, I had every single COVID symptom except for the loss of taste and smell. And the daughter only had a sniffle.
Hmm.
And so that varies a lot. But because that girl was feeling so well and playing normally, she potentially, now fortunately the family, they were already aware that there was COVID and that was a possibility, but because some children are so well, they can go out and play and interact and spread the virus more easily. And that's one of my concerns as a pediatrician and as someone thinking about infectious disease is even if they're not the ones who get the sickest within our population, they definitely tend to be the ones who transfer the virus.
So the ability of the virus to do different things in different people, are those are probably not mutations because we've been following this fairly closely.
Right.
It's individual people that are the big difference. Are there particular, other than diabetes that we've talked about, obesity is another, age, mm-hmm. are there any particular risk factors for children?
So the things that end up landing children in the hospital when they get COVID, as I said, was type 1 diabetes. Obesity, just like adults, is a risk factor for children as well. And then heart problems and seizure disorders. And other than those, the numbers really drop off, including asthma. Like asthma, I would have expected would be a big problem, and for adults, it is. But for children, it doesn't seem to put them at much higher risk of having to be in the hospital than for a child who doesn't have asthma, which was surprising to me.
It almost seems like we don't know more than we know at this point.
Absolutely. Like I said, we're seeing science being done in real time, and we're not used to doing that.
Right. I appreciate that. Dr. Michael Matos, our guest today, and we are talking about COVID-19 and vaccines and children and all of that. And 569-5253 is our phone number. So let's start with this. How does a vaccination work? I mean, we know that it recognizes little pieces of the virus and basically says, oh, okay, kind of puts it on a shelf. If I ever see this again, this is what to do.
Exactly.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yep. And what's interesting about, and what was the reason that the vaccines were able to be developed so quickly, and I mean, I don't think people realized the fact that we could crank out two completely new vaccines within the amount of time that this occurred was just monumental compared to the way it had been done in the past. And that's because all of the research that was required to make those vaccines had already been done. And it's used pretty regularly in the laboratory setting. And so really what we had to do when COVID came about was figure out what the genetic sequence was for the virus and just plug that into the system that we were already using in the laboratory using this mRNA vaccine. And you know, our cells, when they need a protein, they go to the DNA that codes for that protein. The DNA is made into a copy, sort of a working copy called RNA, and then that is used by the cell to develop whatever protein needs to be made. And with the vaccines, they're just injecting the RNA, those sort of temporary templates, and those get absorbed by the cells, and then the cell just treats it like its own RNA and makes, for here, the spike protein on the coronavirus. And once that's done, then the RNA that was injected gets degraded, because that's what cells do with RNA. It's really just a temporary use thing, and once the protein is made, that gets broken down and the parts get recycled. Cells are pretty efficient that way. So things that get injected don't last. They don't ever get into our genome. They don't get into our own DNA. So there isn't sort of a lasting an expectation there's going to be some lasting effect, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Okay, yeah. Now, there's also been talk about another dose for those of us who got the two-shot vaccines, either Pfizer or Moderna, as opposed to the J&J single. Let's start with that. Do you know what the big difference is between the two? Are the technology different?
Yeah, so the single-shot one used a little different technology, and that was more traditional. There are a lot of viruses that look like other viruses. So we all used to get the smallpox vaccine, the one little scar in our shoulder, and that was there was a slightly different virus that was used for that vaccine. And what they've done with the J&J, the Janssen vaccine, is they've taken a virus that actually infects monkeys. It's very similar to the coronavirus, and they use that to just get the vaccine into the body. And just like most viruses, the body then, the cells take up that viral coating, and what ends up getting into the cell at that point is the virus RNA. Then the body uses that to make the spike proteins, and then we know how to fight off the coronavirus.
So it's different from the older style, either dead virus or inactivated ones?
It is. It's a type of inactivated virus, but like I said, they're using a different virus to get the coronavirus RNA into our bodies.
Okay. And what do you say to people who say, well, it's just a flu? And for some people, maybe it is.
That's the tough thing, is I think everybody operates on what's my experience, and it's sort of a protective thing. You kind of want to be able to look on the news and say, well, that's just happening in China, and oh, that's just happening in India, and oh, that's just happening in New York. And just like we saw with the original strain, it's coming closer and closer to us. And that's generally what we've seen in New Hampshire. As we've looked, we had our biggest sort of rates of infection in December and January of this year. And it was down to mid-June to only like 20 cases a day within New Hampshire. And now it's already up to 170 per day, which is 29% more than last week. So we're back in that, unfortunately, in that exponential phase, and it's all Delta virus for the most part. It's almost like we're seeing a new virus. And so part of what I would say to those folks is, look, we're in a new situation again. It's almost like stepping back to the beginning, unfortunately. And what has been proven time and time again is, despite the fact that we can say, yes, if you have this condition, you're more likely to develop a problem. But when you look at specific people, there's no way to predict how your body is going to react to it, mm-hmm. both from how sick is the virus going to make you and how strongly is your body going to react against that virus. Because for a lot of the severe COVID cases, part of the, and this was, again, part of what was hard to differentiate at the beginning of the pandemic and has become more clear, is first of all, the virus does make you sick, but then for some people, their body overreacts, and they go into sort of full emergency mode trying to fight off the virus, and it kind of goes overboard. And that's, so on one hand, early on, for people who are in the hospital, they tend to address the virus, and then later on, as they get sicker, they actually have to address the person's own immune system and actually tone that down because it's sort of overreacting.
Fascinating. We're talking COVID-19 with Dr. Michael Matos of Huggins Hospital. He's a pediatrician and also endocrinology and pediatric diabetes. That's quite a subspecialty.
It is. And when I was finishing my training, I decided that the location was very important to me. And so I wanted to return to New Hampshire. Our family was up here. I ended up doing primary care more than endocrine, but I still use it day to day. It's just something that I always have in my back pocket.
Now, all of us have, the image of doctors, and of course that always includes the surgical mask. We know that about aerosols and things like that, but, mm-hmm. Maybe you can settle the argument. Are they to keep other people from getting sick or to keep you from getting sick?
Well, it turns out it is both, and so initially, the folks at the CDC and Dr. Fauci were saying, wear the mask because it will keep you from getting other people sick. But again, as they gathered more data and looked at outbreaks, they said, okay, well, what makes this person who got sick different from this person who did not? And a lot of times that was because the people who weren't getting sick were wearing masks. So they definitely do provide protection. You do have to have sort of that triple layer that they talk about. A flimsy, thin mask is not going to be the same as a thicker mask. a mask that isn't covering your nose isn't a mask, really, because we do breathe virus out of our noses and mouths. And so that's why they always say it must be a mask that covers your nose and your mouth.
Okay. What do you say to people who say that they can't wear a mask? I'm not saying there aren't any. I can't imagine it. It's not a huge deal, at least to me.
Yeah, I mean, I do know that some people, and we've run into this with some children, if they have a lot of sensory issues, they just have difficulty having that mask over their face. And for some of those families, what they ended up homeschooling their children last year.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not ideal. They're not teachers, but they wanted their children to be safe and yet knew that they weren't going to be able to keep a mask on all day successfully. For those people who are concerned about problems from masks, like I've heard some people worried that they're not going to be able to get enough oxygen, or they're not going to be able to blow off the CO2 that you need to blow off when you exhale. If you see any operating room on TV, you realize every person in that room wears a mask for every case through the whole day for their entire careers. And so for people who say, masks might have an effect on your thinking or anything like that, I know we're not letting surgeons do surgery and make life-changing decisions with impaired, ability. So there isn't anything wrong. I think some people do feel uncomfortable with a mask. I don't want to be wearing a mask right now, but I know that I have to. And that's the other thing that the infectious disease people talk about is, the vaccine is an important part of breaking this chain of transmission, but the masks are as well. Even with the early summer when the numbers were very low, they were saying, yes, an unvaccinated person or a vaccinated person can be in an enclosed space with unvaccinated people, but they should wear a mask if they're going to be close and not able to social distance. So that's still going to be a part of what we need to do moving forward, unfortunately. And I look forward to the time when we won't be able to do that anymore, but until we've got enough people vaccinated and enough people masked and enough virus not transmitted between different people, we're stuck doing this.
No vaccine, of course, is perfect. Have you seen any breakthrough infections?
I don't think we have locally. The interesting thing, again, about breakthroughs, I think some people are, they don't want to get the vaccine, and they're trying to think of reasons why shouldn't I get the vaccine, and then they hear, oh, there's breakthrough vaccines, so it doesn't matter if you get the vaccine. People aren't designed to think about big numbers, and when you talk about the Delta virus breakthroughs for people who are vaccinated, it's only 0.01 to about 0.3%, a very small percentage, but because you're talking about 166 million people who have been vaccinated, that's still 500,000 people who will get Delta virus despite being vaccinated. So from a percentage standpoint, it's a very small number, but there are enough people around that we are going to see that throughout the population.
So it's like getting a flu vaccine where it doesn't mean you won't get the flu, but it will be you won't want to just lie there and wish for death.
Exactly, and they're looking at very specific things. So they found that people who are vaccinated do have virus RNA in their nose, and they said, well, does that mean they can transmit the disease? And it turns out that they probably can for a very brief time, but much less time than somebody who is not vaccinated. So somebody who's not vaccinated, if they get Delta, they're shedding that virus for a much longer time and able to infect other people.
Okay. So testing is or should be part of the whole mission against the virus, as it were?
Yeah, and the testing recommendations have changed over time, and they will continue to change, I'm sure. Right now, moving forward, thinking about the fall, they're saying that if there's a case within a class, before we were testing all the classmates and quarantining all the classmates, now they're saying, well, they'll have to quarantine the family because they're at highest risk for developing COVID, but not necessarily the classmates. They'll still test everybody, make sure they don't have it, but they won't have to quarantine right away. So depending on how prevalent it is at the time and what they're learning about the transmission of this, they'll keep making recommendations, and those will change. And we just have to, you know, accept the fact that the reason they're making new recommendations is because they didn't know what was going on before. It's so that they're learning more, and now they can make better recommendations.
If someone needs a COVID test, does it matter if it's the conventional or the rapid test? Is one more accurate than the other?
It partly has to do with the collection. The ones that are most sensitive are those NP swabs that we originally heard about, which the swab goes way back to the back of your throat. And now a lot of the rapid ones are just a swab on the inside, just inside the nose. So they're much less unpleasant.
Good.
yeah. And at Huggins, there's a Huggins hotline. I should have mentioned this towards the beginning, but if somebody does want to get a test, there is a hotline at Huggins, and you can call that number, and they will direct you as to how you can go about that. The number is 569-7558. And there are people there who have been managing this almost since the beginning of the outbreak and can let you know how to do that at Huggins.
Now, we know the government is paying for the vaccines, but is there financial help for testing, or is there a charge for that?
There's generally a charge for that, and most of the time it's covered by insurance when people have insurance. Otherwise, I think it's out-of-pocket charge.
Okay.
Yep.
And how long does it take now? If I was to get a test, when would I see the results back?
The rapid test takes about 15 minutes. We have patients who call us with like cold symptoms, and as I said, in children particularly, even a minor cold symptom could be COVID. So before we have them come into the office so that we can keep all the staff from getting infected and so that we can keep our other patients safe, we have them go to the testing center before their appointment, and they get their test. Within 15 minutes, they know that they're negative, and then they come to the office so that we can figure out what might be making them sick.
I see. And is that what you recommend somebody do if they have cold symptoms, or is it a little early to push that button?
No, it's always worth testing, just because you don't want to be the person who's contributing to the continued spread of this disease. We'd rather have somebody tested for minor symptoms and turns out to be negative than to have them just develop more symptoms and become sick, or infect other members of their family who might be able to, who might be at risk for being sicker.
I understand. Dr. Michael Matos is our guest today. He's a Wolfboro doctor, a pediatrician at Huggins Hospital. And if you need a primary care provider, you can always look him up there. He's on their website, by the way. You can check it out there. We're talking about COVID-19 and vaccines and children and all of those things. Now, are there particular telltales in children versus a cold or COVID? You know,
the only one, and it's really the older kids who can tell you this, is they lose their taste and smell.
Okay, and that's common?
And that's fairly common in the older children. It's interesting. None of the symptoms are super common. Even fever, which is sort of one of the most common things, that affects like 40% of patients, of children. So it is a little bit different from adults that way. But I would say the taste and smell is probably the only one that really says this is almost certainly COVID.
Okay. If somebody in a household has COVID for whatever reason, and you are not vaccinated, is there a probability somewhere? Can you figure out, okay, since you've got a quarantine for 10 days or whatever it is in that same household, you'd be at a pretty high risk. Is there a number to quantify that?
You know, I don't have that number at the tip of my tongue.
That's okay.
But I can tell you, the family I told you about earlier, where both parents had COVID, they have three children, and only one of the three developed COVID.
Strange.
Mm.
And so, you never know who's, who's going to get it and who doesn't. And
right.
It's the same exposure.
Yep, exactly. And that's one of the tough things. And again, as people trying to prevent further spread, we're trying to emphasize that you can't know that you're going to be the healthy one. You just have to assume that you could be at risk and help prevent it.
Right. Do you think we'll see an FDA approval, a full approval for these vaccines fairly soon?
I think I heard. Let me see. I know that they are talking about the Pfizer vaccine. More importantly, they're looking at early fall for the emergency authorization for the younger children. It'll probably take a while to get supplies up and decide what the exact dosing is going to be. But I expect that for the youngest children, the ones who aren't eligible yet, under age 12, that's supposed to come along sometime in the fall.
And how young do you think that approval would be for?
I've heard the Moderna has been tested down to 6 months, so it may be down as low as that age.
Okay. And this may seem like a ridiculous question, but you never know, actually, because a couple of friends of mine are expecting. If you are expecting, is getting a vaccine a good idea?
Absolutely. The ACOG, which is the American College of Gynecologists and Obstetricians, they recommend that women who are pregnant get the vaccine. They are at very high risk for complications. It's just such a stressful time for the body in general, even when you're healthy. And to have COVID on top of that is really dangerous for the moms in particular.
Okay. Are symptoms in children different than symptoms in adults?
They do tend to be, yeah.
Like, which is which?
Well, in adults, vomiting and diarrhea, some of the GI symptoms are much more common. We don't see that as much in the pediatric population. Dr. Chan, who heads Health and Human Services and does a lot of the discussions on media, has talked about 10% of children only have one symptom. And that's unusual compared to adults. So maybe they might have a runny nose or they might have a cough, but really nothing else. And that's probably one of the other things that's a little more unusual about children.
Are you seeing more parents being more careful with this? Oh, because usually, I mean, let's face it, if you had a sniffle, well, okay, in a few days you won't. But are you seeing more parents bringing their kids to the doctor with what, just to make sure they're not COVID symptoms?
I wouldn't say that they're as worried as, for example, their daycare centers. Appropriately so, I think when the daycares are following the recommendation that if there is a single symptom that can be COVID, you can't just assume that it's not because the child looks well and appears healthy otherwise. That child has to be pulled out of that system and tested before they're able to return back. And so I wouldn't say that parents are bringing their children in necessarily, but I think if a family member has had COVID, then they'll bring their child in, but it's more that the daycare and certainly in the spring, the schools were recommending that testing be done.
Okay. I find it interesting that masks are required on airplanes, but yet you can have a concert with 40,000 people and everyone seems to be okay with that. Are you, as a doctor, are you ready to go to Fenway Park and watch a game?
Nope, I haven't gone to any big crowds in a long time. I can't even tell you the last movie that I saw. I just think it's too much of a risk. I generally consider myself pretty healthy. I exercise a lot. But I just take the tact that I don't know, because I really feel that there's no way to know until you get it with how sick you're going to get.
When children do get the COVID vaccine, COVID virus, pardon me, if you graphed it out, are the number of cases smoothly going up with age, or are there lots of jagged edges in there?
Let's see. So when we look at cases, let's see. And again, this is the kind of thing that's on the Health and Human Services website. In general, the cases are, well, they're higher. Let me start here. So they're definitely higher for Delta than they were with the original strain. So in New Hampshire, we're one of about 10 states where 18% or higher of the cases are children. And that's much more than it was with the original virus. About 6,000 of every 100,000 children are getting COVID, and about 2% of those patients need to be hospitalized.
Okay, as opposed to adults, which have a much higher hospitalization
Correct.
Rate. And it's only 2%.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So let's face it, a lot of us have a lot of anxiety when it comes to this thing. How much of it is overboard? Are people completely, or some people, I should say, letting it take over their life? And
I think it's something so everybody has to decide for themselves how far you go. But I do think that in any situation where you're close to a lot of people, particularly if you're indoors, having a vaccine on board and wearing a mask is just the minimum. I think, and we've seen this as the mask came off during the summer, all of a sudden we were seeing what viruses in children that we typically only see in the wintertime. Some of the cold viruses and RSV in particular, that's something we usually see in January and February each year. But this year, as the mask came off, we started to see it in June and July. It was a really bizarre year that way. So I think you can't overestimate or sort of speak in hyperbole when you're talking about how insidious this virus is. You know, for most people, it's not much of an illness, but they can still transmit it. And there's enough of the population that's really at risk for severe disease that I think we owe it to those people to mask up and get ourselves vaccinated.
All right. My guest today, Dr. Michael Matos. He's a primary care provider at Huggins Hospital. He's a pediatrician. And if you were looking for a new doctor, I'm sure he'd be very happy to meet you. Are there different protocols for different places? Like, I know that you haven't worked for the camp because there's been no camping. But for instance, you're also the doctor for Brewster Academy. A little different when you're in close contact like that in dormitories and things like that.
Right.
Besides the obvious of hand washing and all of that, are there things in particular that we could employ to reduce our risk?
Well, so at an institution like that, and they did this at UNH, all of those students and the staff are tested on a regular basis. When they are testing a large population like that, they actually have the people pool their samples together, because you can do it from saliva or nasal secretions. They're even looking at wastewater coming out of institutions and monitoring that for COVID. But they do it on a bigger scale like that. And then if somebody's, say, a 10-person sample becomes positive, then they test those 10 people individually. And so just by recurrent testing, those institutions have been able to keep their population safe. Brewster did very well through this whole pandemic, despite some people having to go home at times and come back. They did a really superb job.
When people get the vaccine, again, anecdotal evidence, which is basically what my friends posted on Facebook, Moderna, the second dose of Moderna seems to have more side effects than the Pfizer or the J&J. I don't know why, but again, that's just the people that I know. Yep. Or have you seen that in general?
That's true. The vaccines have very similar sort of side effect profiles for all those common side effects. A lot of people get fever, generally aches and pains, headaches, and it is more common with a second shot for those two-shot vaccines. And it seemed like, in general, Moderna did have more side effects than the Pfizer vaccine.
Now, why do those side effects exist?
Well, some of them are basically the response that you want. So when you get the real virus, you get the fever and the cough and feeling tired and sick. We call it malaise. It's just that yucky feeling like, oh, I am sick when you get ill. When you do a vaccine, you do get some of those effects. I mean, you want the immune system to recognize that vaccine particle as a virus. And so you do get some people get fever, the headaches, all those sorts of things that you would associate with getting a cold or getting COVID are similar symptoms that you get with a vaccine, because your immune system has to learn what that is and process it. And in order to do that, all the sort of chemical mediators that do that cause those side effects.
So in a way, that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's how I take it. Exactly.
Okay. What are not some of the side effects of the vaccine?
Oh, that's a great question. So, again, people worry about the RNA in the vaccine being incorporated into our DNA, and that does not happen. The RNA just goes into the cell. It's used very rapidly to make the spike protein, and then that gets degraded. It's even important, well, so I'll use the chickenpox vaccine as an example. So people say, why do we vaccinate against chickenpox? The real chickenpox virus inserts its DNA into our DNA, and it is in our bodies for the rest of our lives. And that's why people get shingles late in life, is because all of a sudden you get a little worn down, your immune system gets worn down, and that DNA is right there in your cells and can be brought up and used to make the virus that causes shingles.
Now, so, I know you're not a virologist, but what to some others that don't?
Oh, it all has to do with the copy machinery that particular virus has. That's just one thing that that chickenpox family of viruses does. They just have the machinery to find the right spot in the DNA, split it apart, insert the virus DNA, and sew it back together. And it just evolved that way. And fortunately, a lot of these other viruses don't have that ability, and they're just temporary invaders, so to speak.
So for those of us who are a little bit older, who are not children, mm-hmm. We've always heard about the flu vaccine. Is a shingles vaccine a good idea? And if so, how often do you get one?
Oh, boy. So I am not an adult doctor, but I can tell you from my personal experience, the shingles vaccine is given at age 50 and higher. The best one on the market, which is an excellent, excellent vaccine, it's about 98 or 99% effective from what they originally said. That's a two-shot series, and I can't remember. It's a couple of months between the two vaccines, but very effective for shingles. And it's so important because a significant percentage of people with shingles have permanent symptoms, and it can be really debilitating.
Now, some people have said that there are various side effects of the COVID-19 virus itself. Like brain fog is one, and a couple of others. Have you, I realize you're not an adult doctor, but have you seen any children with lasting effects from the infection?
I've not yet. I actually don't see a lot of these children back. You know, they get tested for one reason or another, and they have gotten, fortunately, locally, they've gotten through the illness without major side effects, and we haven't heard back from people yet. So I think it's early in the big scheme of things, but definitely compared to adults who I've definitely heard several people mention the brain fog, it doesn't seem like that's as obvious or as recognized in children at this point.
Do you have any idea of how many adult infections turn into something lasting?
No, I haven't looked at that.
Okay.
And I think it partly depends on what they define as a case. You know, all these studies that happen, they really have to define what are the symptoms that are going to be called long-term COVID. And they probably overlap with many other disorders. So it'll be a fair amount of time before we really define what it means.
Okay. So where does Carroll County, I know because a lot of the data is county oriented. How is Carroll County doing as far as COVID infections versus the more populated parts of the state, Manchester, Concord, Nashua?
Right now, we're doing pretty well. Let me see. Having said that, I don't think we have any active cases right now. As far as hospitalization, for example. But we do have a reasonable amount of spread. So throughout the state, they call it substantial spread, which I believe is 150 people per 100,000. And every county in the state, including Carroll County, has that amount of spread. And the other number that the ID specialists talk about is the test positivity rate. So of those people who present with some symptoms and get tested, how many are positive? And within Carroll County, it's 4.8%, which is definitely higher than we would hope.
Okay, I see. 1254 here on WASR as we talk with Dr. Michael Matos. He's a Wolfboro pediatrician, and we're talking about COVID-19, vaccines, children, and all of that other kind of thing. And, of course, we still have a few minutes if you want to get in, 569-5253. Now, if someone wants to get a test, you had a phone number a little earlier in the show?
Yep. So if they want to get a test, the Huggins has a call-in number. It's 569-7558. If someone wants to get a vaccine, they can go to the HugginsHospital.org website, and there's a link there to arrange and schedule that vaccination.
Now, when you get tested, what happens behind the scenes? For, you know, you stick that swab in by my brain.
Yep.
And then how does the test work? What does it look for? Does it look for that virus, that spike protein?
So we're actually looking there at the RNA that the virus encodes the virus. And so the liquid that's in the container, the collection container, helps break down the cells that are collected. And from that, you isolate the RNA, and then there's techniques to use a detector that matches that sequence of the virus that would not match anything that would be in our bodies. And so, and that is tied to literally a chemical that lights up. And so in a machine, when these samples light up, they know that has virus particles in it, not just, nasal cells, for example.
Okay, because they're different.
Right. And so they can be very, very specific for that sequence that tells you that's coronavirus.
So it's not going to false positive on, say, the cold?
It shouldn't. There's definitely, with any test, there's a false positive rate and a false negative rate. And the more prevalent that the disease becomes, probably like we are now, you're actually more likely to get false negatives. It's just the nature of testing and the way the numbers work out. But when there's a lot of virus around, a lot of infections around, you're actually more likely to get a false negative. So, if you have a high suspicion, say a family member is ill and you're developing symptoms and you get tested and it's negative, I wouldn't automatically assume that you're ready to go back to work. You should monitor your symptoms and quarantine and maybe even get tested again if things worsen or change.
A little bit earlier today here, right here on this radio station, during the news, I had heard that this new Delta variant is as communicable as chickenpox.
Mm.
Is that true? Or at least in your experience?
I had not heard it characterized to that degree. But that's pretty concerning because with chickenpox, for example, if someone's in the hospital with chickenpox, we assume that when they leave the room that there's chickenpox floating around in the air for several minutes. And anyone who's never had chickenpox or isn't immunized against chickenpox is not allowed in that room. So that's a high level of transmissibility.
Yeah, it is. Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty concerning. So again, that's why just having the vaccine isn't enough. You really need the mask to also prevent inhalation of the virus particles.
Okay. Dr. Michael Matos, our guest today. By the way, have you been, it says here that you play saxophone.
Yes, I have. And I play in the Kate Bark Band. We were all very sad not to be able to play at all last summer. This year, we decided to play. We're all obviously out in the open. And after we have a practice session, which is running a little shorter than we did in previous years, we have 15 minutes or so before we do our concert so that we have time to air out the area. And that's how we're sort of mitigating our risk.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the Kate Park Band. Obviously, we know where you can see them.
Yeah, it's right. So it's every Wednesday from 7 to 9. We practice from 7 to almost 8 o'clock, and then 8 to 9, we're playing a concert. And it's all volunteer. There's no audition to play. We have high school members and people who have gone on to college come back sometimes, and people are well into their older years who are in the band, and some people will pick up their instrument for the first time in a long time and join us. So if there are people out there who want to play, they're certainly welcome to come.
Fantastic. Doctor, I really appreciate your time today. Is there any last words or anything you'd like to tell us?
Again, I hope people understand that it's really important for us to get as many people vaccinated as possible, and wearing masks when we're in a risky situation indoors with a lot of people. That it's important for most of us to go ahead and get the vaccine, because that's the only way we're going to turn this around and get life back to normal.
Well, Doctor, your time is valuable, and I appreciate the hour you spent with us today. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. It is 1 o'clock. News is next.